Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, this is Patrick Connor from QueensburyRules.com here. I'm going to be joined shortly by James Foley of BadLuckTook.com. This is our inaugural episode of what we're calling Queensbury Rules Radio. Basically, we're going to be doing a lot of the same type of stuff that many other radio shows these days are doing, which is just recaps, previews, talking about boxing, etc. Hopefully that we bring something a little bit new to the table, and I hope that you find our boxing show very fun. And this week, basically, we're going to be focusing on recapping this last weekend's action, namely the Guillermo Rigondo versus Nonito Donaire fight from HBO this past Saturday night, and a couple other things that happened over the weekend as well. And also, we're going to be getting into the upcoming action this weekend, of course, notably Saul Canelo Alvarez versus Austin Trout, which is going to be live in Texas. And so we're going to be talking about those things shortly. I'm going to be having James call in just a moment or two. And actually, I think I'm going to go ahead and patch that guy in right now. James, you here?
Patrick.
Yes, sir. Everybody, James Foley from Bad Left Hook. How you doing?
How you doing, man?
I'm doing
good
pretty
to be
good.
Here.
Are you ready?
Honor to be working with you, sir.
Hey, the honor is all mine, man. I really appreciate you doing this, and hopefully these people like this stuff.
Yeah, I hope so.
So are you ready to talk some boxing, man?
I'm ready. I think we can do that.
So did you catch much of the action from Friday night?
I did. I saw the main event on Showbox, the Angelo Santana, I guess, upset. And I did see the ESPN Friday Night Fights card as well.
All right. Well, then
not the finest offering from the series.
Yeah, I would basically agree with that. And, you know, I had kind of talked about this on, I guess I'll give a quick plug and just kind of mention it and be over with it, but be done with it. But, of course, as you know, I've been doing that YouTube show, Boxing with the Beard. And so anyone who's watched that might be familiar with some of the stuff I have to say. But in any event, I guess we'll start off with the Friday Night Fights card. And, yeah, it wasn't really that good. Did you come away from that card thinking highly of anybody who fought on that card? I guess I should ask.
Well, who was that on the undercard? Oscar Molina?
Yeah, Oscar Molina, the 2012
and
Mexican Olympian.
Not the strongest of opponents there. But, you know, he did what he had to do, and it looked good. And, you know, I guess I wouldn't mind seeing him again. As far as the rest of those characters, Lampkin Jr., that fight with Horseman actually did have a couple decent moments. But, you know, I think overall it was pretty unmemorable. And when you have Rico Ramos as the final act, that's kind of what sticks with you.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you there. For anybody unfamiliar with what happened on Friday Night Fights, Oscar Gonzalez took a unanimous decision over Rico Ramos, and then right under that, it was Oscar Molina who stopped Daryl Gardner in the first round, and then in the opening fight, it was Ray Lampkin Jr. stopping Landon Horseman in the third round. But yeah, it's needless to say, was not very memorable. And I think that when the cherry on top is Rico Ramos, then you're kind of bound to not be in a real good position entertainment wise.
Right, and the Horseman Lampkin fight was decent, probably just because Horseman kind of caught him there in that second round and put him down. I think it was probably more of a flash knockdown kind of balance thing, but it did spark him to, you know, basically a barrage of punches for the remaining, I think, two rounds that went. And, you know, that was decent. But Rico Ramos just, you know, he's never really wowed me.
Yeah.
Or anybody for them.
Well, for a little bit there, it kind of looked like he was getting a push as some type of, sharpshooting brawler almost, where, you know, he kind of knocked the snot out of a couple lower-level guys, and it was impressive. you know, he had
the one big knockout to win the title.
And I forget what that name was. It kind of actually, he reminds me a little bit, not so much like in how he looks or his style or anything, but he kind of reminds me a little bit of like a guy like Joel Julio, who, you know, was pasting guys that were a level or two below the guys that he wound up losing to when he got brought along. But, you know, on top of that, Rico Ramos has proven to be a fairly boring guy in the ring.
Yeah, I think so. It's like he has that kind of methodical style, but it never really leads anywhere.
It seems like somewhere along the line he was depending on power, and that just didn't really pan out, and now we're left with what we got, which is a guy who, you know, he wound up getting knocked down, and I think it was the sixth round from a body shot, and then after that just didn't even know what to do, and the guy that he was fighting wasn't really doing anything special. He was just kind of coming forward and throwing punches. So I think that, needless to say, I don't know where he's going to go from this point, but I'm not really all that interested in seeing any more Rico Ramos main events.
Yeah, I think he's become one of the most, least looked forward to fighters that's appeared on TV over the last couple years.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess I'd also like to quickly go back to what you were talking about, the Ray Lampkin-Landon Horseman fight. For a lot of people who don't remember, or maybe the name sounds familiar, but they're not sure who Ray Lampkin Jr. is. Ray Lampkin Sr. is the guy who challenged Roberto Duran in, I want to say, 1979 or something like that, and he wound up getting stopped in the 14th round of a 15-rounder. So that's really his only claim to fame, and that's why the name might sound familiar to some people. But that fight against Landon Horseman was actually a pretty decent fight. I mean, it was sloppy. It definitely wasn't high level. But, you know, Lampkin kind of got caught in the middle of a flurry and went down from a right hand and then came back to beat the crap out of Horseman.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was one of those kind of situations where if he doesn't get out of that round, or if he was badly hurt, that's pretty, you know, sets him back pretty far, and came back and definitely finished strong. And, you know, I'm sure he'll end up, you know, popping up on the airwaves again sometime.
If for no other reason, because of his name, but also on top of that, he's, I want to say, 29 years old. You know, if he were 19 and had a loss early on his career or something like that, that's one thing. But, you know, getting...
Okay, yeah, I can't say I was familiar with him going into that, so I didn't realize he was actually that old.
Yeah, I actually wasn't super familiar with him either. This was only, I think, his third or fourth fight, so... You know, he doesn't have a lot of experience, but needless to say, we'll probably see him again. Let's see, what else was going down on Friday night? Also, Showbox, which you had mentioned. The main event was Bahodir Mamajunov versus Angelo Santana. I think I get some extra credit for pronouncing that name right. That's kind of a tough name.
Yeah, that sounded difficult.
As a guy from Uzbekistan, I have seen him, I think, once before, and also it's kind of one of those names that's memorable, so I've seen his name in the press a little bit. But Angelo Santana, he was coming into the fight, kind of a highly touted guy and a power puncher, and he had a pretty strong amateur career and everything like that. And so, yeah, it was definitely considered an upset. What did you think of that fight?
It definitely surprised me. But, you know, these guys with their last names ending in V have been on quite a run lately. So
yeah.
you can't count out that, you know, that kind of Siberian, you know, toughness mentality. But, I wasn't too familiar with Santana. I remember him on Showbox the last time he was on there, and he had kind of a much, you know, better performance. But I guess, you know, he was kind of Don King's last hope, maybe.
Yeah, man, needless to say, Don King's kind of floundering right now, and this didn't help his case.
It's been a rough few weeks for him. And I actually,
yeah.
I like Boris Cloud a lot. I don't know if he has, I guess it's becoming more and more clear he doesn't really have that pound-for-pound level upside, or will he ever be the best guy in his division, but he's a fun fighter to watch. I think he's got a good attitude. I like the guy. I definitely think his career has probably, floundered a little bit with Don King. It seems like he's only going about once a year,
And of course, you know, alluding to 48-year-old Bernard Hopkins, as great as he is a, I think, a pretty major setback for him.
Oh, yeah. I would definitely agree. Go ahead.
Cloud and Santana, I think, are probably King's, you know, last guys on any kind of notable level. And that you'd think this probably takes Santana off of that level.
Well, my guess is that, you know, Santana's Cuban, first of all. But my guess is that Don King was still chanting Puerto Rico at the post-fight press conference somewhere.
I think I saw the flag, yeah.
Yeah. Well, hey, I agree with you, though. I like Tavoris Cloud. You know, he's a guy that, for the most part, you know, when he's forced to fight, he throws a lot of punches. But, yeah, he definitely showed against Hopkins that, you know, he was outfought pretty easily in that fight and dominated pretty badly. And I think that was just about the last hope that Don King had. And I don't know what he's going to do from this point, because he doesn't really seem all that interested in promoting boxing anymore.
Yeah, it seemed like just a depressing scene that whole night. You know, they showed Cloud's locker room, and you had Don King and Thomas Hauser's in there, kind of, you know, recording the last bit of notoriety for this guy. And
yeah, no
joke. You know, I again, not underestimating Hopkins, but I it's just so unbelievable that he can do this to these guys 20 years younger than him. You know, a guy as active as Cloud is. That he can do what he did, again, is just a testament to Bernard. You know, I thought Cloud had a good chance to win that fight just on activity, you know, and just
without
physical, throwing a lot of punches and, you know, maybe trying to get a controversial decision. And it's like, it wasn't even close.
Yeah, without a doubt. And I mean, I pegged Cloud to win that just because I keep figuring that at some point Hopkins is going to get old, and I'm getting kind of sick of waiting for that. I mean, I've been picking against the guy for I don't even know how many years now, but he won't go. He won't die.
Well, you know, and he looked old in the Chad Dawson rematch. You know, he finally looked like a guy who was just, you know, almost fighting more to just kind of go the 12 rounds and you know, content to just have good defense. And, you know, I didn't think that fight was really a blowout for Dawson. I thought he clearly won it and clearly had the most, you know, majority of the rounds. But, you know, he didn't particularly damage Hopkins or anything. But it's just the way Hopkins was fought that I really thought, okay, maybe, you know, finally he's just not going to be able to hang with these young guys anymore.
Yep.
But obviously Dawson is a more sophisticated boxer than, you know, Cloud is. And
yeah, and actually that was just what I was about to say. And, you know, I think there's something to be said for the fact that I think that clearly Cloud is not a very cerebral type of guy. And, you know, you do kind of have to look at what happened and say, yeah, well, Bernard Hopkins won, but at the same time, it was Tavoris Cloud who probably was kind of overrated in the eyes of many. But even any way you slice it, at, you know, 48 years old, that's an impressive thing to do, is, you know, defeat a guy that's so much younger than you, number one, but also number two, you know, towards the top of a weight class.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Cloud's not a slouch. You know, he's not like he probably was a top five fighter at light heavyweight. And yeah, I guess it just shows you kind of the difference between great and good, right?
For sure. And we kind of got a little off track, which is totally fine, but actually, I wanted to just go back quickly and comment on that Showbox card. The main event, which was Mamajunov versus Santana, like we were talking about, basically what wound up happening was Mamajunov went down early on a jab that he looked kind of off balance for, and then he came back to dominate the rest of the fight, kind of first using boxing and then slowly creeping over into the pressure side and breaking down Santana, put him down with a bunch of body shots, pretty gnarly body shots in the eighth, and then in the ninth round put him down twice before it was stopped. So, you know, it wasn't a really great fight by any means, but, you know, it was interesting enough to keep my attention and interesting enough to you know, it was deserving of the show, which is supposed to match you know, undefeated or close to undefeated prospects and, you know, pseudo contenders. So I was cool with it. And also,
yeah,
on the
going into it, I thought it was kind of a showcase for Santana. And
that's what it looked like, especially
for
Yeah, and especially for a guy in Mamajunov that was coming in, I think it was like a little over a week.
Yeah, that's right. I completely forgot about that.
So, I mean, you know, it's not a real good look for Santana, but, you know, it happens. And on the undercard, it was Amir Imam taking out Jeremy Bryan with a pretty damn nasty knockout with a 1-2 in the second round. Did you catch that one too?
I didn't see it. I did read about it, and you know, sounded awesome.
You didn't really miss that much. It was, you know, a round and a half of action, but I mean, the knockout itself is worth checking out.
Yeah, I read a few recaps and stuff. I can't remember exactly why, but I did end up tuning in late to that show box. And I think I actually caught like the second half of the Santana fight. I missed the knockdown, but I did see the end where he was basically just getting battered around the ring. It looked like he was badly hurt at the end of the, I think, 7th or the 8th, came out for the 9th and just didn't have his legs under him. And yeah, it was pretty shocking to see that, just based on the expectations going in.
Well, and I think that if there's any Friday where we had an excuse to kind of be messed up as far as the schedule goes, it was this past Friday, because number one, Showbox came on before Friday Night Fights, which almost never happens. And
yeah,
then
that
on top
odd.
Of that, you
that
know,
was odd.
Yeah, and it was a late Friday Night Fights in the first place. It started at 8 p.m. my time and, you know, 10 p.m. your time. And then on top of that, started like 40 minutes mm-hmm. late because of, you know, the spectacular, monumental achievement of mankind, NASCAR. We basically just watched these dudes take laps for a half hour before Friday Night Fights even started. So, yeah if anybody missed those fights, I think they could kind of be excused for that.
If you did
miss them, nobody's going to blame you, is what I was going to say, because it wasn't spectacular anyway.
Yeah, and it was also one of those situations, kind of the bigger fight on Saturday, you know, juggling time around trying to watch boxing. And I think the Saturday fight was, you know, definitely the draw from last weekend.
Oh, yeah, no doubt about that. And actually, before I wanted to get into that Saturday, the top-ranked HBO card, I wanted to ask, did you see the Juan Diaz comeback fight at all?
I didn't watch it. I've been meaning to go on YouTube and check it out. I love Juan Diaz. I didn't really think much of the opponent, Pepino Cuevas Jr. So I figured it was kind of just bring him back, you know, get him some rounds, give him a nice knockout. I haven't watched it yet, so.
You pretty much just recapped the fight right there. I mean, that's pretty much what you just did. It was on, I can't even remember what channel it was
Yeah,
on.
I don't think, I think it was the time, like, it was on Fox Sports Network.
I feel like I only get that temporarily or sometimes, because sometimes I can't even find the channel on my, you know, in my 4,000 channel guide. But yeah, you pretty much recap the fight as it was. It was Juan Diaz throwing a lot of punches, you know, applying pressure and slowly breaking down Pepino Cuevas Jr., who, no offense to the guy, kind of sucks.
So what do you think about Diaz? Do you think he's got any chance to kind of get back to the top of the division? It was a lightweight fight, right?
Yeah, it was at 135, which I guess on one hand is good. But I've been saying, number one, I've been a fan of his for, you know, a handful of years. But I've also been saying, as has a couple of guys who know him and are closer to him in his camp that I know, we've all been saying that we thought that he can make 130 pounds if he really needed to for a couple of years now. And yeah, he looked soft around the middle. He didn't look super svelte or anything like that. I mean, number one, not every fighter is going to be coming into every fight yoked, you know, completely, you know, muscled out of his mind and stuff like that. And he's also proven that even though he does look soft, he fights hard into the late rounds. So I don't think that stamina is necessarily an issue. But to me, it was just that when he retired, he seemed happy to retire. It seemed to me like he was going to be moving on, going to school, and he seemed content to do that. So I'm kind of just and also I've heard that he's pretty set financially, so I'm kind of just I'm concerned about what his motivations are for coming back and how far he's going to go. What do you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would have actually thought that he might come back heavier just after the layoff. And wasn't he fighting at 140 the last time he was out? His fights with Malignaggi were at 140, I think.
Yeah, well, I think that the...
And obviously not successful.
Yeah, well, I actually thought that he did better than most thought in the first Malignaggi fight, and I don't know if I necessarily had him winning, but
yeah,
I thought it was
pretty close. Yeah, I kind of remember that, too. Yeah, I think actually that was much closer. I don't think it was, the biggest robbery in the world. I thought Malignaggi got the better of it, but maybe a 7-5 wouldn't have been crazy. So,
yeah, and I wasn't super upset about Diaz taking that one.
And it was a pretty terrible style matchup for him.
Yeah, Paulie's not a good style matchup for just about anybody. We can talk crap about him all day, but, he rarely makes anybody look good. So there's that.
Yeah.
But actually,
Pablo Cano. But
what's that?
I was saying, except Pablo Cano.
Yeah, apparently.
Decent. But no, I mean, I think Paulie's, definitely past his best days. I think he's slowed down a little bit. But, as far as Diaz, it is, he had this kind of great story. He was going to go to law school. He was getting out young. It's kind of like the ideal that you hope for. And he's such a likable guy. And, you look at the fights with Marquez and kind of looks like, okay, he had a ceiling. He fought against the best fighter in the division, one of the best fighters at any weight, and pretty decisively lost. Obviously, the first fight got stopped. But, so where does he go on his comeback? I don't know. I mean, I was thinking about it, and, I think he could definitely make some entertaining fights with some guys. But, is he ever going to get back on that stage again with a Marquez or be able to be competitive in that kind of a fight?
And that's the concern that I have. And I was going to say, actually, the second Malignaggi fight, and I could be off in my memory of this, but I think the second Malignaggi fight was some type of weird catch weight or something like that, but I don't remember exactly. I think that Diaz was kind of demanding some type of weird catch weight, but regardless, not important. I wasn't that surprised that he didn't come back over 135 because I just don't think he could compete at 140 right now. I think that's pretty much where it is. He's not going to be able to compete there, at least not right this second, not against guys like, Lamont Peterson, Matisse.
No, yeah.
There's just nobody there for him, right? I don't think so. I wasn't surprised he didn't come back over 135.
Yeah, I guess you look at the lightweight division, and it's, not exactly murderer's row anymore with all those guys having moved up, with Marquez, Guerrero, Rios, Broner's gone, it seems like he's gone. So, but what's interesting about it is all those top fighters aren't the kind of fighters who would make, a great fight with Diaz. It seems like all those guys at 135 are all kind of boxers, Miguel Vasquez, Richard Abreu.
Yeah.
And,
exactly.
You just got to wonder with the time away from the ring and damage that he's taken in the ring, can he even be as good as he was 4 or 5 years ago?
I think that's a legit worry and a legit question because,
I love watching the guy fight. That first fight with Marquez was awesome. It was great. It was one of the fights of the year.
And you know what was a pretty good fight of his that I see literally almost nobody ever talking about was when he won the IBF lightweight belt from Lokva Sim. It was part of a triple header. I can't remember what card it was on without looking it up, but it was part of a triple header, and they went to war. He won pretty clearly, but it was an action-packed fight where those guys were tossing pretty hard. But, guys like Miguel Vasquez, Richard Abreu, those are not good matchups for him, needless to say. So I'm in agreement with you there.
Yeah, I hope for the best for him. I mean, I'd love to see him, do some things, win a couple fights, maybe get into a big fight. It's tough to be optimistic about anybody who's kind of coming off the losses that he had and then taking, 3 years away from the sport. and the type of fighter that he is, you know, to come back and compete at the highest level, which, you know, if you can't compete there, it's almost kind of, you know, what's the point of having came back? But
and
that's obviously, you know, that's his prerogative.
And in kind of what you were getting into a minute ago is looking towards the future. I mean, the issue is that he is fun to watch. And the reason why he's fun to watch is because he doesn't have a really great defense and he throws a lot of punches. And so going forward, I think you do have to kind of worry about a guy with that style who's going to get hit a lot. And, you know, if he's getting hit a lot against a guy like Vasquez, who is sharp with his shots, doesn't really punch hard enough to take you out, you know, those are the type of fights that are dangerous when you're just sitting in there taking a sustained beating and can't do anything about it. So, yeah, there's some concern there for sure, and especially from, you know, coming from, you know, you and I guys who like him. You have to worry about his long-term health. But, you know, I guess I'll continue to support him by watching. Sounds like you probably will too.
Well, it's tough, man, because if you follow the sport, you got to worry about that with everybody, you know, and so that's kind of the dark side of being a boxing fan. You know, all the guys we see that we like are going to end up, a lot of them are going to end up taking a lot of punishment. You know, a lot of them are going to end up talking differently when they get older. And that's just, that's part of the deal, you know. And it sucks to see it happen to someone like him, if it does. But, you know, it sounds like he does have a lot of other things going on outside of the sport. And, you know, hopefully he at least has the option to pursue that if it doesn't work out. And get out before taking those kind of, you know, more punishment later into his career.
Yeah, and at the risk of opening the floodgates to an entirely different conversation that we're probably not going to go into today, that's one of the reasons why I think we need to really look into taking better care of the fighters that we, you know, well, fighters in general, every fighter,
yeah.
Not just big-name fighters or guys under this staple or under that banner. But, yeah, I think that, and we'll get into it, I'm sure, in some future episode, but we need to take better care of the guys.
It's a tough situation, you know. It's always better, I think, to be safer, you know. And if that means taking away some of the drama, some of the excitement, I mean, we've already done that in a way, you know. Like referees stop fights so much quicker nowadays than they did, you know, 50 years ago. You watch tape and guys are unconscious and the refs like pulling them up to the, you know, pulling them. Continue fighting,
dragging them to the corner.
But bottom line, it's a dangerous sport. It's always going to be. You know, I think probably the most important thing would be getting fighters to retire younger. But I don't know how that could, you know, how that could possibly be mandated, because there's so many guys who end up, you know, just becoming journeymen and just taking beatings, and you know, and that's the kind of thing that's really troubling, I think.
And then, of course, the counter argument to that, and this is even opening up a totally different Pandora's box, but the tendency in recent years for guys to be excelling at a much more advanced age than they used to. I mean, you know, when I was doing research for, you know, older articles, and, you know, I knew this before that, but it's just that when I do research and I'm reading about guys from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and then, you know, the press back then is saying, well, he's 28, so he's getting kind of old now, or, you know, well, he's 31, so his career is pretty much over, you know. And I'm looking at that and going, like, you know half of these guys, their career is not even getting started by 28. So yeah, I think that that's kind of, like I said, could potentially open a bit of a Pandora's box in terms of the, you know, performance-enhancing drug discussion. But again, you know, these are the types of topics we could talk for about for hours. So,
I know we have a lot of other stuff to talk about, but it kind of reminded me, the one recent fight where I felt that kind of emotional response to seeing a guy get hurt, because normally I feel like I can separate it. It's, you know, obviously it's a sport, you know, the risks and all that. But seeing Timothy Bradley getting just battered the way that he did by Ruslan Provodnikov, it was a great fight, but it was, you know, seeing that happen to a guy like Bradley, who comes off like such a gentleman, you know, and he took so much shit over the Manny Pacquiao thing, which wasn't his fault at all.
you know, I was a little uncomfortable. I mean, that was like the kind of fight. You're watching a guy just giving a piece of himself in the ring.
Yep. No,
you know,
it's
tough. I mean, the whole goal of this thing is really should just be make as much money as you can and get out with as much of your health as you can.
Yeah.
You know, but yet we want to see these guys keep fighting. We want to see these matchups. You know, we want to see Pacquiao Marquez 5, even though Pacquiao might be damaged permanently from, you know.
And I think the part that's probably most messed up about the Bradley Provodnikov fight, which was really good fight, by the way, but I think the part that's the most messed up about it is that whether or not you had Tim Bradley winning the Pacquiao fight, and I highly doubt you did because
no.
I couldn't find a whole lot of, you know, a lot of people who didn't have their head up their ass who had him winning, but the messed up part is that whether or not you had him winning, he tried his ass off to win. It wasn't like he quit halfway through, stopped throwing punches. He tried. It wasn't enough, and he was getting kind of bruised around the ring a little bit, and then he has to come back and get totally, you know, trialed by fire against Provodnikov for his troubles, even though he won the fight. You know, I didn't think he won, but, you know, history is going to say that he won, et cetera. And so, you know, even though he won the fight, he wound up having to come back and get his ass kicked, you know, just to kind of prove that he wasn't some chump. And
I was just going to say, one thing I thought was interesting about that, if you remember in the first round when he got hit with that big punch, but there was a delayed reaction and he went down and the referee ruled it a slip. And, you know, he tried to get up and then he fell right back down, which is obviously he was badly hurt. You know, most of the time, I mean, if the referee called that a knockdown and the guy gets up and then falls right back down like that,
fight's
a
over.
A lot of times they're waving off the fight. And I've wondered,
Zab,
you know.
Zab Judah.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I wonder, had that happened, would Tim Bradley maybe be better off? You know, he wouldn't have gotten the glory. He wouldn't have gotten the heroism of just, you know, such a bloody performance. But he would have taken so much less damage.
Yeah.
I mean, he would have definitely had to rebuild himself after that. But, you know, as a fighter going forward, maybe the Tim Bradley who gets waved off in the first round is better than the guy who just went through that.
Yeah. I mean, that's a valid point. And actually, it didn't occur to me exactly like you said, but actually as I was watching the fight and when he went down again from that, you know, they called it a slip, but I mean, it kind of looked like a knockdown. And when he went down the second time from it, I kind of gasped because I was like, is he going to stop it? You know, because like you said, in those situations like that, the ref's like, that's
well,
it.
Having ruled a slip,
know?
I don't know how he could have then stopped it. You know what I mean? I think once you ruled that a slip, I don't see how he could have stopped it then.
For sure, and I would have kind of, I'm sure that he would have caught in a ton of shit for doing that, but at the same time, you know, I did kind of have that thought in my head as I was watching it, but I think you bring up an intriguing point, though.
Yeah. Well, I guess we should probably talk about, you know, the Nonito Rigondeaux
graphic
on Saturday.
We could talk about things that are pertinent, I guess. So on the undercard of the Guillermo Rigondeaux versus Nonito Donaire fight, I don't want to go through every individual fight. I didn't in my YouTube video, and I don't really feel like doing it now, just because there's a lot to talk about, and in my opinion, not a ton of it was worth talking about, you know, individually, fight by fight. But I'll just kind of rattle off a couple names. Well, I'll put it this way. I'll rattle off all of them except for one name that I thought was worth talking about. Let's see. The guys who scored stoppage wins on the undercard on toprank.com were Sean Monahan, Jesse Hart, and Mikhail Jezuski. And then a couple of decisions were won by Tyler Canning and Glenn Tapia. And none of their opponents were really all that noteworthy. So it's not really worth, you know, talking a ton about. I mean, if you have anything to add to it, by all means, please do.
I have nothing on that. I've seen Monahan a couple times. I think I've seen Monahan twice in New York. He's kind of a you know, local Irish draw there.
Mm-hmm.
But
if you got anything else, go for it, because I don't really have that much.
I got nothing on that. I've heard Glenn Toppy is a decent prospect to watch. I don't remember if I've seen him or not. I think you didn't mention, but Omar Figueroa was the one guy that undercover that I... Oh, no, he's fighting this Saturday.
Yeah,
Yeah, I didn't get a chance. I was babysitting four kids and basically had to put them to bed right before the HBO broadcast started, so I didn't actually catch the Top Rank undercard.
Yeah, I have one child, and I have a tough time watching this stuff live. So, you know, multiply that by four, and trust me, dude, I understand. Yeah, as far as those guys, there wasn't a ton to talk about. I've seen Sean Monahan. I've seen video of him, I want to say once or twice before. I've seen Zuski a couple times before, and I know of Glenn Tapia. I want to say he's like 18-0 or something like that at this point, but coming up fairly slowly. Yeah, there's not a lot to add to all that.
Just to mention, I mean, I'd like the Top Rank streams its undercards.
Oh, yeah,
you know, I think that's great. I know a lot of people, most of the time I don't watch it, but I think it's a great option to have, you know, and if there is an intriguing fight on there, then I will, but I love the fact that they do that.
Well, when you have an outside life, when you're not, you know, 18 or 19 years old and able to sit in front of your computer all day long, it's tough enough for me to set time aside to watch a handful of fights, much less, you know, two dozen over the course of a weekend or a day or two. It's kind of a lot. But
have veto power over all of our viewing activities.
I would say that is a fair assessment, and it applies to pretty much all of us. Unless you have a wife that really likes boxing, which is not super common. So at least not at the level that we like it.
I haven't found that yet, but you never know.
Well, I guess the only other thing that I wanted to talk about before the main event talk was Felix Verdejo. He wound up stopping Steve Gutierrez in the first round. I think that it was just significant because Verdejo looked good, and he's kind of been getting a little bit of press, a little bit of talk after this past weekend and scoring that win. Did you see that fight at all?
I did not.
Yeah. Well, whatever.
I did not, man. Go ahead. I know Verdejo, and you just never know when a guy's this early in his career, you know?
Oh, yeah. At least now you just let everybody know what type of clown you are, co-hosting the show with me and not watching that fight. Good job.
Yeah, did you see that one? No. this weekend, I really only could focus on that, you know, the main event there.
No, that, if you were going to catch any of the fights, that was going to be the one to catch, needless to say.
I've got to lay low with everything coming up in the next few weekends, you know.
Well, you can't exhaust your boxing allowance from your wife all in one weekend.
Exactly.
Well, I guess the only reason, aside from that he looked good, that I wanted to talk about it was that he was a 2012 Olympian for Puerto Rico. And actually, there was a handful of Olympic hopefuls and Olympic participants fighting this weekend, but he was among them. There's not a whole lot more to say about the fight. Gutierrez didn't look good, and he got walked down easily. So that was pretty much the story of that. And on to the main event, of course, which was Guillermo Rigondeaux versus Nonito Donaire. Tell me your thoughts. What did you think?
Well, you know, I thought it was actually a pretty good fight. I don't understand a lot of the criticisms about, you know, people saying that it was totally boring. And, you know, compared to what's been on recently with the Bradley fight and that Rios and Alvarado, obviously, it's a different thing, but I thought it was, you know, tense and suspenseful, and, you know, I thought Rigondeaux, he had a game plan. It wasn't particularly surprising. He didn't change anything. He did what he does, and, you know, I was surprised that Donaire really didn't seem, he just didn't seem like he was in it. I mean, from the beginning, Rigondeaux just started running away with the rounds, you know, and, I mean, it was...
Go ahead.
Well, I thought Rigondeaux he fought a great fight, you know. And I think that his hand speed was a big factor. It seemed like he was sparring right through Nonito's guard. I do think both guys boxed pretty well early in the fight. I thought, you know, Rigondeaux, obviously, defense is a little bit flashier because he moves a lot. But, you know, Dinero was blocking a lot of shots, parrying some shots here and there. But the real scoring blows were all from Rigondeaux, and it just really surprised me. You know, and even when Dinero had his moments in the fight, Rigondeaux would come right back and end up getting the better of him. I also, in that sixth, I think right before the seventh round, where Kellerman was interviewing Roberto Garcia.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lampley came away from that saying, well, you know, if Garcia thinks this is an even fight, my confidence in Dinero coming back is a little bit lower. And I kind of agreed with that. You know, I just thought his response, I mean, I know you're being interviewed. It's not, you know, and maybe it's not an entirely honest transaction, but he just didn't seem like there was any fire in that corner to try to motivate Nonito to, you know, start picking up the pace, which he really needed to do to give himself a chance in that fight. You know, and when you're fighting against a guy like a slick counterpuncher like Rigondeaux, I mean, activity is so important. Even if it's not, you know, even if you're not hitting him, you're hitting him one out of every six or seven shots. Just giving the impression of that, you know, goes a long way with the judges. I just thought Nonito never gave himself a chance to win that fight.
And I think that one of the most surprising things to me was that Rigondeaux dominated, well, at least on my card. I scored a 10-2. I didn't have it remotely close, so... You know, I thought that I don't want to say that it makes guys like Marroquin and, you know, other guys that Rigondeaux has faced, it doesn't necessarily make them look better per se, but I was just surprised at how easily he dominated the fight, really.
Well, I think Marroquin gave him, you know, was pressing the action a lot more, and I think he was giving himself a much better chance to win. And I think Dinero, I don't know if he thought it was a close fight or he thought maybe he would get the benefit of the doubt in every, you know, potentially close round. I don't know. I mean, I was surprised. I was very surprised too. I didn't think it was close. I thought maybe anywhere from 8 rounds, and even the 11-1 scorecard I thought was reasonable. You know, I thought maybe you could give Nonito 4 rounds, and you're giving him the benefit of the doubt in a few close ones.
Well, I guess I'll kind of get to my more in-depth thoughts about the fight in a second, but first I wanted to ask you, number one, where did you have, well, I don't even know if you make pound-for-pound lists or if you agree with them, like them, dislike them. Personally,
I don't mind them. I think they're fun to look at sometimes. You know, it's good for debate. As far as like where did I have Nonito in that? You know, I thought he was right there. I think at the top I would have had Mayweather and Marquez, and then right behind that Sergio Martinez and Dinero.
Okay,
oh, and Andre Ward. I completely spaced out about Ward. Yeah, I think I'd have Mayweather and Marquez the top two, and then Andre Ward, and then probably Dinero, Sergio, you know, in either position.
Yeah, I would say that assessment is pretty fair, and so that was the first part of my question, and I guess the second part of my question would be, do you think that Rigondeaux moves into that spot or close to that spot?
Well, if you're making those lists, I think you've got a case to put him around there. I don't know if I would put him ahead of Martinez, but I think he's right there in that next tier, you know, behind those four. And a lot of it too is just career achievements. I mean, guys like Marquez, Mayweather, and Sergio, it's what they've done for the past few years. You know, in Mayweather's case, for over a decade. You know, so it's with Rigondeaux. I mean, this is really his first big win on that level. But yeah, I think he's in that next tier. You know, as far as being one of the best fighters in the world, I think he showed that.
I agree. I'm with you pretty much 100%. I think that
he's a great boxer. You know, he's a great just defensive boxer, and he's got quick hands, and it's a great combination. You know.
Well. I'm definitely not going to be the one to tell people what they should or shouldn't be talking about post-fight, but I think that a little bit too much of the conversation was about, that the fight was boring, that no, I don't want to see Regan Do again, you know, stuff like that. When there hasn't been as much talk about the type of performance that we saw. Basically, we saw a masterful performance.
I had pretty low expectations. I think most of us did, because we know that the styles that they have, and it was certainly possible that it was going to be, you know, a fight with a lot of feinting and kind of maneuvering and not a whole lot of exchanges. And in that respect, I think it probably exceeded those expectations. You know, there were moments of drama. I mean, right from the get-go, the fact that Rigondeaux, you know, that first round was one of his best rounds. And, you know, I think the fact that you had the favorite and, you know, the pound-for-pound guy and the big puncher kind of digging himself a deeper and deeper hole made it interesting. And there was certainly, you know, a middle stretch of that fight that was pretty kind of, you know, boring. I mean, there wasn't a lot of action there. But I think that 10th round happened at just the right time, you know, because right as it was kind of getting tiresome and you're feeling like, okay, Rigondeaux is just cruising to this thing, you know, he got caught with that punch coming out of the clinch, and that injected a little life into it. And then I thought the last three rounds were really entertaining.
And on top of that, to speak to the terms in terms of like how competitive it was, or you know how the scoring might have swung either way or whatever, that 10th round, I thought that Rigondeau came back pretty clearly, and I don't want to say that it was a 10-9 round. You know, I'm willing to kind of throw Donaire the bone here and give him the 10-8. But, you know, the last 2 minutes of the round were, for the most part, dominated by Rigondeaux. Enough to offset that point? Probably not. But then the last two rounds were very clearly for him. The 12th was, on my card, darn close to being a 10-8 round for him.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the 10th round was a 10-8 for Nonito. Just with the knockdown, and he was also kind of had him backpedaling for about a minute afterwards, but you know, Rigondeaux definitely closed the round strong and was getting the better of it when the bell rang. The 12th, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I was just hoping for drama at that point, you know, so I wanted Nonito to turn the tables, because that would have been the best story. And as soon as he got hit with that one punch at the beginning of the round that messed up his eye, that was pretty much out the window, you know, and then he was in survival mode. And I don't know if I've seen that before, where a guy's just covering, you know, one part of his body with his glove. It was pretty amazing that Donaire could even survive that round fighting in that condition. But, you know, he certainly, his chances of getting a knockout or doing something spectacular were gone as soon as you saw that the condition that he was in.
Well,
and that was really surprising to me. You know?
Well, I don't want to kick a guy when he's down, or you know, start questioning the validity of, you know, his post-fight interview when he's saying his shoulder was hurt. And I also don't want to be like, oh, his eye wasn't that bad. Although, I mean, I do think that it's fair to point out that there have been a number of other guys who have fought with injuries.
Oh, yeah.
Worse
there, there's guys who have fought with way more gruesome stuff. But, you know, whatever was going on at the time, he obviously felt like he needed to keep his right glove up just to protect himself.
Oh, yeah.
And it basically gave himself no chance to do what he needed to do to actually win the fight, which at that point would have been, you know, actually, if he would have just hypothetically won the 12th and scored a knockdown, I think he would have been a split draw.
And actually, yeah, from the scorecards, you know, it wouldn't really have taken that much more effort in terms of the scorecards to win a decision or to keep his belt, withdraw, or whatever the case. You know, it really wasn't that far away, even though I would have disagreed with that a lot. You know, it was within his grasp, and he didn't reach out and take it. And that actually leads directly into what you were talking about before about Garcia. And actually, I kind of disagree with you only slightly about his corner. I agree that when they were doing the interview with Garcia, I think it was right before the sixth round,
I think it was in between the sixth and seventh, because he had said that he thought it was an even fight.
You might be right.
So I think it was
after six. I don't remember the exact
but,
round.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't remember the exact round, but I know it was about halfway through. And I agree with you that either he wasn't being honest with himself or he was just kind of, you know, saying what he thought he should say as a trainer. But when it got back to the corner after that round, that was actually the point at which I started noticing Robert Garcia saying, all right, now you got to start actually throwing jabs and working off your jabs and your volume has to go up. And I don't think that he necessarily failed as a trainer or that his corner was bad. I can't speak on the circumstances before the fight. You know, I'm not privy to any of the details that go on in that camp or anything like that. I don't have friends there, but, you know, from all reports, it wasn't a very good camp. You know, but put all that aside, what we can speak on is what we saw during the fight, and at the very least, in the last third of the fight, they were asking for Nonito to throw more and do something to help himself out, and it looked like that 10th round was basically, that was all he had, and even then, that wasn't like some type of punch that he worked for minutes at a time to set up. You know, they kind of came in, they clinched, and as they were on the way out, their way out from a clinch, he caught him with a left hand that popped Rigondo kind of off balance, and he went down and got up pretty quick. And after that, like, that was it. That was pretty much the last hurrah from him. So in any event, I guess all I'm saying is that I didn't think it was a terrible showing from his corner, and that I think that it also speaks to a tendency for Donaire to not be able to adjust very well during fights that he's not dominating. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I think that was a big problem. You know, it just, yeah, as far as the corner, I just feel like if ever there was a situation when you that kind of intensity, you know, locker room speech would have been necessary, that's kind of what I was looking for. I mean, I think he was encouraging him to do the right things, but I just don't know if he was really stressing the, you know, how critical of a situation that it was. And maybe they didn't realize that they were that far behind.
You know who he needed in his corner? You know who he needed at that point? He needed Teddy Atlas. He needed Teddy Atlas to step in and say,
he needed somebody to be sitting on his stool.
I've got your kid on the phone. He's asking me, why is Daddy not fighting? Why is he not fighting? That's what he needed in the corner.
That's what I thought. I mean, I just thought Garcia really should have let him have it and let him know. But, you know, everybody's got a different rapport. And maybe he knew that wasn't the right tack to take. But whatever the reason, you're right. I mean, Nonito did not adjust. You know, he didn't change his strategy. He just seemed so content to kind of sit back and bounce around and, you know, let Rigondeaux kind of pick him apart. And, you know, at a certain point, he needed to just let it all go. You know, and he didn't do that. And I think it was really telling that in the 12th round, the guy who had a big lead came out and, you know, it was probably Rigondeaux's best round of the fight. I mean, at a certain point, it looked like he was just battering him around the ring with that bad eye.
Yeah, it was bad.
You know, with a fighter like Donaire, with his power, for a guy like Rigondeaux, with a lead like that in the 12th round to come out and really make a statement, I thought it was really impressive. You know, he really put a stamp on that fight with that, you know, and anyone criticizing him for running, I mean, look what he did in the last three rounds.
Now, don't get me wrong, because I'm probably not going to be going out of my way to book last-minute flights to go see Rigondo fight in New York City or something like that, you know, but for my part, I enjoyed the action. I thought it was a pretty masterful performance, and I thought that he definitely, at the very least, earned another main event.
Yeah, I would have liked to see more punches too. But the bottom line is, like, Nonito never forced him to go to that level. You know, he never needed to throw more. So he expended the least amount of energy that he needed to basically win almost every round. You know, I mean, it's definitely a more appealing style. I personally prefer the guys with speed and movement. I enjoy that. But, you know, it's definitely more appealing when guys are throwing a lot of combinations while they're backpedaling or, you know, having some kind of, you know, offense. But that said, in this particular fight, he never needed to do that. You know, Donaire wasn't pressing the pace where Rigondeaux would have needed to have been more exciting. So, you know, if you can win a fight and expend the least amount of energy doing it, that's a good thing.
Well, and on top of that, you really only get away with what, the ref really wasn't a factor, but you really only get away with in the ring what your opponent lets you get away with. You know what I mean? Like, it's if you're being the guy that is, I don't want to say avoiding a firefight or whatever, but, you know, not every style is made to go in balls out and, you know, throw shots. But if you're being successful in kind of slowing the pace down and pecking the crap out of your opponent, then the responsibility really is on your opponent to do something about it. It's not, you know, your opponent's responsibility to make the fight look good necessarily, but I can't imagine that Donaire was going into like the 11th or 12th round thinking, oh, I got to be way ahead. And if that's the case, then number one, he was mistaken. And I think that you have to assume that you're down going into the last round. But number two, you know, he had to have known to do something. You know, he had to have known, you know, don't let this go to the cards. And he did. He let it go to the cards, and that was that.
Well, I think there were so many times when Rigondeaux, for the most part, he was moving, but there were plenty of times when he was right in front of Donaire, and Donaire just wouldn't let his hands go. And you know, for fear of being counterpunched, yeah, probably. But that's what he needed to do to give himself a chance to win. You know, he was trying to almost, like, set him up for a perfect shot. And very early, it was evident that wasn't going to happen. And the only way he was probably going to break through that guard was to throw more punches and be more aggressive and use his physical advantages, you know.
And he just
didn't do it.
I'm not going to say that if he goes buck wild, he wins the fight. But even just looking at that 10th round, how the round started out with him coming forward and throwing punches, and he got the knockdown. And like I said, I'm not saying that if he would have continued that he would have won, but that's at least a start. You know, it's something. And he didn't continue, and we got what we got, Rigondeaux to win.
And you know, the way he's kind of set up that knockdown was interesting because, you know, it wasn't really like a totally clean knockdown in the course of an exchange. It was, you know, coming out of a clinch, he kind of shoved Rigondeaux back and had him kind of off balance, out of position for a second, and he just hit him with that left. And, you know, I think if he had gotten more physical in the fight, kind of pushed up against the ropes when he had the few opportunities to do that, it would have gone a lot better for him. You know, but he seemed like he was content to just keep stalking him and not really doing a whole lot. So
I'm with you.
You know?
And I guess before we move on and get to the preview part for this coming weekend, I guess the last question I want to ask you is, where do you think this leaves Donaire at this point? Because I think that's kind of the post-fight talk. There's been kind of a lot of post-fight talk about nobody wants to see Rigondeaux again. You know, he was boring. Let's not watch him again, et cetera. But a lot of the other post-fight talk has been, where does Nonito go from here? So what do you think?
Well, like you said, I think Rigondeaux clearly is the man at 122 pounds. I think all the big fights there really should go through him until somebody beats him. So I think it's unfair if he doesn't, you know, continue to get face off against whatever the top rank can give him in that weight area. But as far as Donaire, I think he can definitely come back from this and continue to have a great career. I don't know. I mean, it sounds like he's going to move to 126 and that they're possibly lining up some kind of a fight with Juan Manuel Lopez, which could be interesting. You know, I think it's a very winnable fight for Donaire, and it would probably be a more appealing fight aesthetically than this last one was.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think it's the end of the road for Donaire at all. But I would like to see him eventually rematch Rigondeaux. You know, I think it's really important for guys to kind of, if you want to be great, I think you have to handle that kind of unfinished business. And, you know, Rigondeaux's got him for now. And I think he needs to even that score for his legacy's sake.
I'm with you pretty much 100% on that. I think that Nonito probably will come back. At what capacity, I'm not entirely sure yet, but he's not going to be coming back as a journeyman, that's for sure. He's definitely a
talented guy. No, I mean, like,
he didn't
take any kind of a beating in that fight. And that's another important thing. I mean, I know he did take some damage in the last round,
but I don't think it was a kind of significant punishment. I think it's more of a confidence thing, you know, and how he responds to that will be interesting. But physically, I think he'll be fine. And I think he will take some time away because he's got a baby coming. And, you know, when he comes back, if he fights Lopez sometime around the end of the year, I think that's a good start.
I'm with you pretty much every step of the way there. So let's get to the stuff that's happening this coming weekend. I guess we'll start small and talk about this coming Friday, Friday night fights. I guess really the only fight on there that I'm interested in talking about is Javier Fortuna, who is headlining the card against Miguel Zamudio. I'm not overly familiar with Zamudio, but Javier Fortuna has been on a handful of pretty much every prospect of the year list for 2012. Towards the end of the year there, he wasn't looking great, but he definitely looks like a guy who's showing a lot of promise and can punch. Are you familiar with him at all?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I like him a lot. I think he does have a good upside. He seems like he's a good puncher. He's definitely quick. He's a good boxer. So, you know, I'm interested to see where he goes from here. I think he should win the fight on Friday. I don't know a lot about it. He's fighting Miguel Zamudio.
Yeah, I'm not super familiar with him.
And I'm not terribly familiar. I if you look at his resume, he really hasn't been in with any type of opposition that would kind of give you pause to pick Fortuna here. So I like Fortuna. You know, he had that kind of tougher than expected fight against Patrick Hyland. Was that on the Pacquiao Marquez card?
I think so. Yeah, and that's what I was talking about there at the end of the year.
Yeah, and then he had that spectacular knockout on ESPN Friday Night Fights last year against Yuan Dale Evans.
Yeah.
So I like him, and he's one of those Samson Lefkowitz guys.
Uh-huh.
The greatest talent scout in boxing.
Yeah, right now he is, that's for sure. I agree with you on there. He's got actually a handful of guys. He had a couple of guys lose in this past year, but he still has a handful of guys that he has, you know, basically Simon Cowell'd his way on up the boxing ranks and has brought to semi-stardom. So I agree with you there. And I
brought a man named Manny Pacquiao over.
Yep. A lot of people forget about that. And a lot of people forget about a lot of the crazy stories about Manny that were circulating around when he was just kind of getting big as far as who he was going through with management and promotion, and et cetera. Man, he's had one hell of a ride, and at some point Manny Pacquiao is going to come out with a biography, and I'm going to read that, you know, a legit biography. But as far as Fortuna goes, I enjoy watching him too. He's kind of a, I don't know, I don't want to compare him too much to a guy like Miguel Cotto, but kind of similar to a Miguel Cotto circa like 2004, where he was a much more kind of seek and destroy type of guy. And I enjoy that style for sure.
Yeah, I like his style too. And, you know, he seems like one of those guys who's probably just a couple fights away from challenging for a title. So, yeah, it definitely makes the featherweight picture more interesting.
And it doesn't really look like that Friday night fights card is going to be all that eventful aside from that. You know, Fortuna, he is still basically a prospect, you know, forget all the belts and stuff like that. You know, it's so easy to get a belt these days that it's kind of tough to deem a guy a champion just because he won some type of belt.
Featherweight's another one of those divisions that's kind of thin, you know, after Mikey Garcia. And I guess Daenerys is going to go up there. But beyond those guys, you know, you got Orlando Salido. But, you know, I think Fortuna can get himself into a position pretty soon, next few fights, to, you know, kind of be on that next level there.
Well, I guess to be fair, that he probably should be called more of a contender than a prospect, as I was saying. But, yeah, I mean, it's tough to say that he is elite, and that is kind of a talent jump from that mid-level at 126 to the elite level. So, yeah, I agree with you that it could be kind of interesting to see where he he goes from this Friday and what kind of road he takes towards unification or fighting one of the other bigger guys at 126 pounds. What else is going on this weekend aside from the big stuff? Actually, on Saturday afternoon on NBC Sports, Tyson Fury and Steve Cunningham are fighting, in addition to Curtis Stevens and Derek Finley on the undercard of that kind of afternoon card. What do you think of these afternoon cards?
That's a good card. Yeah, I like them. I mean, I like them a lot. The last one they did was the Tomas Adamic, Steve Cunningham, where I felt like Cunningham easily won that fight, and Adamic got kind of a weird decision, originally announced as a draw. But, I, you know, I love what those guys are doing, and I think Tyson Fury-Cunningham is a great matchup. I think it's getting overshadowed by the Canelo fight later that night, but that's, you know, that's a nice Saturday afternoon. I mean, that's... And I think the undercard there is decent, too.
You know, maybe 2 years ago or so, I would have looked at a matchup like that, and I would have said, you know, number one, Tyson Fury isn't that good, and number two, Steve Cunningham is a cruiserweight. You know, what the hell are they doing with this type of matchup? But, yeah, after that fight with Adamek, I thought that Cunningham should have won, like, pretty much everybody who watched it seemed. And now I don't want to say that Tyson Fury is, you know, knocking on the door of being a heavyweight champion necessarily, but I will say that I think that he's improved from when I first saw him. You know, when I first had seen him within the first couple fights was when he punched himself in the face pretty hard.
Right.
So, you know, to me that was kind of like, well, who is this clown that they're trying to position for a title? Yeah, it was kind of like, who's this joker that they're trying to position for a title? And then now he's actually looking like a real fighter. He's a big dude. He's got kind of an interesting story behind him because he comes from a gypsy heritage. And, yeah, I think I agree with you that that's kind of an interesting main event and a decent fight card, especially for a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, I mean, I, it's one of those fights where I think it's pretty tough to predict. I think Cunningham's obviously more skilled, but I think Fury, with his size, is a huge advantage. You know, I mean, what's he going to be giving Cunningham, 50 pounds in the ring?
Yeah, it's going to be quite a size difference in terms of height and, well, I mean, not a ton of height, especially not when we're used to seeing, like, you know, Vlad Klitschko versus some dude that's like 5'8", but, you know, there should be a pretty significant size advantage, but we've seen Cunningham in tough, and he's a tough dude, kind of tough to pin down, and yeah, that should present at least a challenge for Tyson Fury. We should learn something about him.
It's tough because you know, Cunningham didn't look great against in the last couple of cruiserweight fights against Yoan Pablo Hernandez.
Yeah,
and. But I really thought he just completely outboxed and picked apart Adamek, who probably, you know, hasn't really been the same since the Vitaly Klitschko fight. But,
yeah.
You know, it was impressive nonetheless. And Fury is pretty unproven, you know. I mean, he's a couple guys. He has went over Derek Chisora, who I think showed up pretty overweight for that fight and kind of a list of performance. And at the time, you know, just sort of stock really rose after that when he had that controversial loss against Robert Helenius. And he held his own. You know, he went to 12 rounds with Vitaly. But Fury, he's coming off a decision win over Kevin Johnson.
He also got glossed.
Tough to pick.
He got glossed, mate.
What's that?
He got glossed. He got gloss from
yeah.
David Haye, mate.
I love
yeah,
sure.
he, what a character. I'm not a huge fan of him inside the ring, and he's done some pretty crazy
outside
stuff.
Outside the ring, he's always he has crazy eyes. You know,
yeah.
Capable of anything.
He's definitely a character, needless to say. And, you know, he gives a pretty solid effort more often than not. So, but, yeah, I'm with you on that one as well. We're agreeing a little bit too much tonight, I think. But, hey, it can't all be perfect, I guess, on the first broadcast.
Well, what is your gut on that one? Are you leaning any way?
I think that Tyson Fury's camp is probably fairly confident of a win, or else they wouldn't really be putting him in. And I don't mean to suggest that they're matching him soft or that they're afraid to really put him in with someone, you know, huge. But, you know, he's despite what he says, and he says that he's a fight or two away from fighting a Klitschko, you know, despite what he says, I don't think he is. I think that he still needs a little more development and that his team knows that as well. And so I don't think that they're going to be putting him in with someone that they think has a real great chance at beating him. So I'm picking Tyson Fury, probably by stoppage, but also probably maybe after a couple shaky moments, because Cunningham's not going to go down without a fight. What are you thinking in that fight?
I'm probably with you. I think if I had to pick, I would go Fury. Not really confident about it. I mean, Cunningham's always been, I've thought, kind of enigmatic. You know, you're not sure if he's going to have a great performance. So I don't know. I mean, I think Cunningham could certainly, and I think if Cunningham does outbox him, but it's a relatively close fight, you'd like to think that he'll get the benefit of the doubt after, you know, taking that loss against Adamic. So I don't know. I mean, I just think it's a really tough fight to pick. If I had to, I guess I would go Fury, just because I think he, you know, this is huge for him. I mean, I think he has a lot to gain, you know, and if he wants to keep that upward trajectory, he's got to beat a guy like Cunningham, where he's going to have a significant size advantage.
And you know what else was kind of a trip to me when I was looking it up and doing some research? When I looked up Steve Cunningham's his resume, because I was just kind of like, hey, you know, I'm not super familiar with what he did before he got kind of a little bit more famous. I mean, the guy was facing contenders in like 2004. So, and I just didn't even realize that he had gone back that far. You know, I thought that it was more like, you know, the first, I think when I had first seen him, I want to say it was on like it was either a Friday Night Fights or like a Wednesday Night Fights or something like that card against Kelvin Davis. And that was in like 2005 or something like that. But anyway, the point is that he's been around longer than I thought. He turned pro in like 2000 or something like that. So
he's not a super young guy. Yeah, he's got to be
36. He's like 36. So, I mean, at some point, you know, and he's actually been in a handful of pretty tough fights. So I think that it's also worth, you know, pondering when he's going to kind of burn out, because he's been in a handful of pretty tough fights.
I think the Fury pick is also good, just kind of based on where Tomas Adamic is at in his career. And the fact that, you know, he was able, even though I think he clearly lost, you know, he did win a few rounds. I mean, I think it was probably in, you know, an 8-4-ish type of fight. And I do think Fury would probably stop Adamic. So, I don't know. I think the size is going to be a big factor there.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and I'm not sure if he's going to be able to take that kind of power from a guy that big.
Yeah, and that's kind of what most of it comes down to for me, is that, you know, can you look at a matchup like this where one guy is clearly, they're trying to showcase him anyway, although it's kind of under the guise of putting him in tough. You know, I think that you just kind of have to take a closer look at what they have in mind, you know, for both of those fighters going forward. So also that this coming weekend, actually, on Saturday as well, and I don't want to talk too much about this, but the dude we were just talking about, Derek Chisora, is fighting Andre Paula. I'm not familiar with him at all.
Forgot about that. Is that on the Cleverly undercard?
It is, on Box Nation. I'm not familiar with his opponent at all, but, you know, we were just talking about Chisora being a character and, you know, fairly fun to watch. And the main event of that is Nathan Cleverly versus Krasnichi, I think it's pronounced. So, I don't know. What do you think of that card?
I'm probably not going to make it a point to have to watch that, to be honest. You know, it sounds like, I don't really know much about Krasnichi. I think I've seen him, seems like kind of a straightforward fighter. I feel like Cleverly's probably going to handle him. You know, I'd like to see Cleverly come over here and get a big fight with another guy in the division. They've talked about Cleverly and Hopkins.
Yeah,
you know?
I was actually able to see Cleverly do his thing on the Mares Moreno undercard, and I'd
right,
seen him before.
Yeah.
I wasn't totally unfamiliar with him or anything like that, but you know, seeing him live, I'm not one of those people that's like, oh, you know, you've never seen a fight if you haven't seen it live. I'm not like that, but it does kind of add a little bit more perspective, I think, to seeing a guy. And to me, he seems like he's going to be kind of a tough out for a lot of guys. Throws a decent amount of punches, but doesn't have a whole lot of power. Slaps a lot with his shots, too. So, I don't know. I'm not super interested in that fight, but I thought it was worth bringing up because he's a top light heavyweight, and they have talked about matching him with Hopkins. So, you know, it's worth bringing up at least, I guess. Let's see, what else is going on Saturday? Obviously, the big fight that's happening on Saturday, and the big fight card, is Saul Canelo Alvarez versus Austin Trout. So give it to me. What do you think?
Yeah, I can't wait. I think it's one of the best matchups. You know, there's been so many great fights this year and towards the end of last year, and I think this is, you know, one of the best matchups. Not necessarily going to be the greatest fight, but, you know, this is really, you know, a huge step up for Canelo, and I think it's really his chance to kind of, you know, get himself a lot of credibility among the fans who just kind of, you know, doubt him because he's so popular, which seems like it happens to every popular fighter. At the same time, there's legitimate reason to doubt him because, you know, his level of competition hasn't been great. He has fought a lot of smaller guys and older guys, and, you know, this is, I think, going to be really interesting to see what happens. I mean, I think it's a great opportunity for Canelo because the Trout stock is so high right now, you know, mostly just on the basis of that Cotto fight. And, you know, the interesting thing I've thought about this is Cotto obviously was a great fighter, but he has taken, you know, he has been in some really tough fights. He has slowed down a little bit. He's not particularly, you know, big for the junior middleweight division. And so I think Trout caught him at a, you know, great time. And by virtue of that, I think Canelo is catching Trout at a great time, too, because he's fighting against a guy, you know, whose stock is maybe higher than it really should be. You know, it's not taking anything away from Trout, but if you take away that Cotto fight, I mean, Trout's level of competition and his performances haven't always been as spectacular as they were on that night, you know?
Go ahead, sorry, go ahead.
No, just that, you know, prior to that fight, I mean, if you remember when he fought Delvin Rodriguez, you know, seemed like he was content to just kind of, like, you know, come apart from the outside, move around. It was really not an appealing fight. And prior to that, he really, you know, hadn't fought anyone beyond, like, kind of a journeyman level. Canelo's brother and David Lopez. And, you know, I think Trout's a really good fighter, but I think, you know, everyone's kind of looking at this matchup with Canelo's so unproven, and he's got so much to prove against Trout. But I think Trout, There's maybe still some questions, too, how he's going to adjust against a guy with Canelo's size and with his skills in his prime. You know, he fought a great fight against Cotto, but I think this is going to be different for both guys.
What I think is interesting is the fact that no matter who wins, and I mean, you know, I certainly hope, I don't want to, like, jinx it now that I've said it, I hope it doesn't end on a headbutt or draw or, you know, some BS decision or something, but assuming everything is on the up and up, no matter who wins, someone's stock is going up. And that's what I think is interesting, that kind of it goes to what you were saying, where they're both catching each other at the right time for different reasons. And that basically, if Trout wins a decision, it's kind of validating that more slow and steady wins the race type of style that he has and his skills. But if Canelo winds up winning, he's beating a legitimate contender that's fought, if I'm not mistaken, as high as 168 pounds. So it's kind of like, you know, giving him some credit finally when so many people are ready to write him off as a guy that just faces, you know, unworthy opponents. So I think that it's a worthwhile fight. But in terms of the styles and the actual matchup, what do you see happening?
Well, it's one of those fights where, you know, you have two guys who are kind of facing each other's biggest test, and sometimes what happens is guys are tentative, and you get a lot of that kind of, you know, and we saw that a little bit with Daenerys and Rigondeaux. It's, I mean, obviously on Daenerys' side, but that's certainly a possibility, I think, where Canelo might be a little wary of Trout's, like, boxing skills, and Trout might be a little wary of Canelo's, you know, power and combinations, and you could see some dull rounds. I like to think that both of these guys realize the stakes. I think it's going to help that you're going to have such a huge crowd and it's going to have a really big event feel. And, you know, I think there's a good possibility these guys might go for it, and you're going to see a pretty amazing fight with a lot of exchanges and a lot of action. You know, I mean, that's obviously what we hope for, but I think the thing with this fight is anything's possible. I could see it going, you know.
Not to be the proverbial hater, because I actually do like Canelo Alvarez. I know it's not super popular to like the guy, but basically I think it is fair to bring up the fact that he was wobbled pretty good by Matt Hatton. And I don't think that
really.
I didn't see that.
I never thought he was wobbled there. Didn't he get wobbled by Cotto's brother?
Oh, I don't. Yeah, I don't even know why I said Manhattan. I meant Cotto's brother. But yeah, you're right. Sorry.
Okay. Yeah,
you're right. You set me straight there. But in any event, now I sound stupid saying this, but in any event, I think that it's fair to bring up because Cotto's brother Abner or
Jose Cotto.
Yes. They both have a Miguel in there. It's confusing. It's like my brother also having Patrick as his middle name or something. But it's pertinent because he's not a very big puncher and he's really not that great of a fighter. So we haven't seen that type of change from Canelo since, and he seems fairly comfortable at the weight. But I think that that's worth bringing up because Austin Trout, even though he's not a big puncher, he's a sharp puncher. You know, he delivers straight.
He's a better puncher than Jose Miguel Cotto.
Yeah, I would agree. So, in terms of the actual matchup and the style, and for some reason the police are out today. It's like sirens all over. But in terms of the actual matchup, I can't really see Canelo fighting any other way but trying to go forward. That's just kind of what he does. That's how he fights. And I think that from there, it's basically going to be on Austin Trout to find a way to stop that, whether it's going to be from, you know, sharp counterpunching that stings or moving away. I don't really know. But I'm kind of torn. I don't really know what I'm going to pick yet because I still have to kind of think about it a little more. I think that it's that close of a matchup.
I think so, too. I think why it's such a great fight, because I think a lot of people are having a hard time predicting. I think that there's a tendency maybe to kind of favor Trout just because Cotto was probably the best opponent that either of them faced. But it's just interesting how these things play out, you know, because like Cotto's performance against Mayweather kind of revived him a little bit. The fact that he was able to be competitive for a few rounds, that he caught Floyd with a few good punches. So going into that Trout fight, you know, Cotto still had a pretty good, you know, pretty solid reputation. And you know, I thought Trout fought, you know, incredible. I mean, he really, I thought Cotto was going to win that fight. I just didn't particularly think a whole lot about Trout. You know, I thought he was a good, solid fighter, but I just thought Cotto would beat him. And he fought great, but I think Canelo is going to be a different beast.
There were a couple rounds there where I was a little bit worried for Trout because it looked like Cotto was kind of building confidence and he was starting to kind of catch a groove there in the middle rounds. But
yeah, it was interesting.
Shut that down.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like Trout seemed like he won the first two rounds, and then Cotto really came on, and he was catching him with some good punches. And then in the second half of that fight, Trout just took over, and he was just getting the better of all the exchanges. And it was,
yeah,
you know, it was really impressive. It was a great performance. But you know,
agree.
Just because he beat that version of Miguel Cotto, I don't think necessarily means that he's gonna, you know, dominate Canelo Alvarez. Because I don't know. I do see something special in Canelo. You know, I do see, and the other thing about this fight, they're both gentlemen. You know, Trout is such a good guy. He comes across so great in these promo shows and in interviews and things. And I think Canelo's got a really, you know, friendly personality, enjoyable personality too. I think it's a good fight in that sense too. It's kind of got, you know, two honorable men, you know, duking it out for superiority in the junior middleweight division.
Yeah, and finally we get to see Canelo in a fight, you know, not against Archie Solis, a guy that's like 113 pounds soaking wet.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a big challenge for him, but I just have a feeling he's going to do it. And I think it could be a real star-making performance for him. But from Trout's point of view, I mean, he's got so much to gain from this, too. You know, it's a real high-stakes fight with, you know, the winner's going to have a lot of great opportunities for him. And I think Canelo can afford to lose. He's, you know, he's young enough and he's popular enough. He's going to have plenty of other chances down the road. But I think for Trout, this is big.
Well, we literally have almost exhausted all of our time. We have about 3 minutes left. I can't believe we actually went through all of that time. But real quick, before our time is up, I just wanted to also mention that Omar Figueroa is the guy you brought up. Is actually also fighting Abner Cotto. That's why I had Abner Cotto on the brain, I guess, earlier.
Yeah.
another member
of the Cotto family.
I know it's getting to be kind of a Brady bunch of fighting at this point, and the youngest one in curls. So, what do you think is going to happen in that fight?
Well, I like Figueroa. You know, I think he's probably gonna stop Abner Cotto. I haven't been impressed the couple times I've seen Abner. And I just remember, like I was mentioning earlier, I remember Omar Figueroa on that Showbox last year against a Puerto Rican prospect, Michael Perez, who had I think Perez was the favorite in that fight, you know, and he was a decorated amateur. And I was just really impressed with how Figueroa, you know, he took a lot of punches there and just kept coming forward and you know, had a really focused attack, and he kind of switches to southpaw sometimes. You know, he adds a little nuance to it. I think Figueroa is a guy to watch for. So you know, I'm definitely going to favor him in that fight.
Yeah, I'm with you. I, on top of not having much time left, there's really not a whole lot for me to say different from what you said. I've only seen Abner Cotto a couple times, and I haven't been super impressed. I'm actually familiar with a couple of the opponents that he has fought and beat and just aren't very impressive. So I think that his resume is definitely lacking, and I wouldn't be expecting him to win that fight. That said, we have just over a minute left in the show. So did you have anything in particular that you wanted to say or any shout-outs or anything like that you wanted to do before we wrap this up?
Well, just wanted to say thank you to you for kind of setting this up, and obviously our boy Tim Starks, the proprietor of Queensberry Rules, great guy, kind of gave us the idea. So hopefully we didn't completely disappoint him, but, you know, we can always do better the next time.
Yeah, and for anybody who is worried about the sound quality of what we're doing, you know, we can always improve on that in the future. This is the first show. We just kind of wanted to see how this was going to go first, you know, whether or not anybody was going to dig it and listen to it, et cetera, and we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah.
And that said, I guess
we've discussed
I'd like
using
to
walkie-talkies in the future broadcasts.
Yeah, I brought up the idea of a couple of cans and a piece of string, but that didn't go over so well with Blog Talk Radio. Real quick, I'd like to thank Scott Christ, or Christ, I'm not even sure how you pronounce it because I've never spoken to him, for also lending you to us for the show. We have a couple seconds left, and so thank you for anybody who tuned in. I'm Patrick Connor, James Foley over here, and thank you so much. Queensberry Rules.radio, BattleLefthook.com and BattleLefthook.com. Thank you very much. All right. Can you hear me still?
Yeah, man. Awesome.
All right. Well, that was the end of the show. So, yeah, dude, I thought that that went pretty well, actually.
Yeah, it went decent. Oh, man, I was just, like, nervous. Never have dabbled before, so hopefully...
Dude, I thought you did good.
Ram too much or anything. But you're right, man. I definitely in the future, I want to, like, you know, like, have a list of things with some notes, because there was a couple times where I was like, fuck, like, I thought of shit to say, and then, like, on the spot, just couldn't pull it. But,
And that was kind of like the YouTube stuff wasn't like a trial run for me or anything, but it did kind of give me a little bit of practice, because it's either I go through the whole video or I wind up fucking, you know, stopping it and you know, that's it. You know, and then I have to re-record. So
dude, man, you